Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is science writer David Quammen, and we're talking about his book, The Tangled Tree, A Radical New History of Life. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mark. Good to be with you.
This is a great book, and I just want to say for the benefit of the audience, there's a lot in here. How many years did you work on this book?
It took about 5 years.
It's all in there. It seems like there's a lot more in there. But this is, and I have an idea that the book is structured like the Tangled Tree because people come in and go out and go in. And I actually thought you might have structured it that way.
Oh, yeah. I care a lot about structure. I write these big, complicated books about science with lots of characters, lots of facts, lots of ideas. And sometimes people say, well, it's a big grab bag. He's got all this stuff. And they don't realize that I'm a student of William Faulkner. I started as a novelist and a literature student. I did my graduate work on William Faulkner, studying the structures of his complicated novels. And so when I write a book about the tree of life and horizontal gene transfer, or about some other complicated subject, emerging virus diseases, I'm informed by a close reading of Absalom and The Sound and the Fury and the great complicated books that Faulkner published in the middle of the 20th century.
I love that. Now, this book overall, as you mentioned in the beginning, is about three main things. It's the discovery of a whole new form of life that might as well have come from Mars. Horizontal gene transfer, which we'll talk about in a minute, and then about the revelation that possibly our own ancestry could be the result of what's called infective heredity. Now, those are those three main subjects, but there's also a lot else going on in this book. And one of them is that it's about the evolution of a very old concept of how to represent evolution, and that's the tree of life.
That's right.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a minute, because the tree of life, actually, the idea of it starts with Darwin, but it sort of gets perfect with Ernst Haeckel.
Yes. Well, and it began as an evolutionary concept with Darwin. The tree of life is an old phrase, an old metaphor that's been around. It goes back to the book of Revelation, probably represented Christ and the blessings that he brought, like leaves and fruit on a tree, to humanity. But then with Charles Darwin, it became suddenly a picture of the evolutionary history of life on Earth, with a single trunk representing, single origin or just a very few starts to the process of life, and then just a couple major limbs diverging upward, limbs diverging into branches, branches diverging into lesser branches, eventually twigs and leaves representing the canopy of biological diversity on Earth as we see it today. So it represented that divergence over time yielding biological diversity. That was the canonical Charles Darwin tree of life. And it was important. And then there were, as you mentioned, Ernst Haeckel, who was a great German naturalist, biologist.
And an amazing artist.
And an amazing artist, late 19th century. And so he started creating Darwinian trees of life, but the difference between him and Charles Darwin was that he was a terrific artist. So his trees of life look like fine woodcut drawings of great oak trees, and made this concept even more forceful. He was one of the great popularizers of Darwinian ideas in the late 19th, early 20th century, and part of what made him a great popularizer is that he could draw.
Yeah. And man, could he draw.
Yeah.
Now, as the book proceeds, as your book proceeds, the tree gets more and more funky until at the end, it's not really a tree. It's something else entirely.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, my earliest working title for this whole book was The Tree of Life is Not a Tree, embracing the paradox that there is a certain tree-ish aspect to the history of life, a very strong tree-like element, but there is this other pattern that does not involve divergence of lineages. It involves convergence of lineages.
Wow.
And the limbs and branches on an ordinary biological tree do not converge with one another. They don't come together. And that's why this tree is a tangled tree, because the history of life does involve these convergence of lineages as well as divergence.
And this is also a book which is about many, many researchers. And the people who sort of slowly in bits and pieces put these ideas together. But there's one overarching one, and that's Carl Woese.
Yeah.
And let's talk about who he was, because he's there in and out for the entire book.
Right. As I started reading my way into the subject back in early 2013, I came across some of these discoveries. I came across the concept of horizontal gene transfer. And then very quickly, I came across this one guy, this microbiologist at the University of Illinois in Urbana, Illinois, where I happen to be right at the moment, actually. And his Carl Woese, and he was the spider in the middle of this great web that I was suddenly learning about. He made, you mentioned a discovery that he made back in 1977, that there is a third kind of life on planet Earth, unsuspected to exist before he came along, a third major kingdom, or as they call it, a third major domain of life, a third great limb coming out of the trunk of the tree of life, and that's this group of creatures known as the archaea. Archaea, as in old, as in archaic, archaeology, because they were thought to be perhaps descended from the oldest form of life that had ever existed on Earth. They looked like bacteria through a microscope, but he started sequencing their genomes using very primitive early modes of genome sequencing, and he discovered that these things not only were not bacteria, but they were more different from bacteria than they are from us, from complex creatures, from animals and plants.
Now, many of the archaea are what are called extremophiles?
Yes, yeah. And the ones that he learned about first were all extremophiles. They lived in hot springs in Yellowstone Park and highly acidic environments and highly salty environments and places where there was no oxygen, and they had to metabolize carbon dioxide and they produced methane. Strange
wow.
creatures.
Wow. They're also at the vents, in the ocean, too.
Deep oceanic yep. vents, right, yeah. Now we know they exist in a lot of other places, too, but at the beginning, they were thought to be these extremity-loving creatures, very strange, almost as though they came from another planet or something like that. But they were very earthly. They used the same genetic code as other creatures, but they're drastically different, as I said, from anything else.
Beyond that, though, and this is what's great about your book, is you get into the person. And he was a very complicated person.
Yeah, Carl Woese. Yeah, he was a quiet, small microbiologist with a deep, deep curiosity about the early history, the earliest history of life on Earth, going back 3.5 billion years ago. He wanted to understand what had happened early on and ever since to create the tree of life as we thought we knew it in the 1970s. And that's why he was inventing this new technique for genome sequencing. He was a crotchety guy. He could be irascible. He was very private. He was a bad lecturer. He couldn't explain his discoveries very well. As I said, he was deeply, profoundly curious. He could be a real grouch. He could be a bear. He was profoundly brilliant, but he could also be a goofball, getting all beard up with one of his friends on a Friday afternoon, and then going to Cheech and Chong movies. You have to love a guy like that.
He's you do
kind of guy that writers live for, a fellow who is brilliant, but also curmudgeonly and complicated, and some people loved him and some people hated him and some people loved him and hated him
at the same time.
Yeah.
And he was always resentful that he didn't get the notoriety he thought he deserved.
Yeah, he got a lot of recognition. He got one of those MacArthur quote unquote genius awards, and he was elected to the National Academy of Sciences. He got awards of all sorts, but he never got a Nobel Prize.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to win a Nobel Prize, I'm told, generally, but it's especially hard to win one if you're a biologist, because there is no biology category for Nobel Prizes. The closest they come is physiology and medicine.
Yeah.
And his work never seemed to fit that category. There are other biologists, such as Francis Crick and James Watson, Barbara McClintock, who have won Nobel Prizes, but it's a rare exception when they give the Nobel to a pure biologist. And Woese never got one. A lot of people thought he should have had one, and he probably led the list of people who thought he should have had one.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is noted science writer David Quammen, and we're talking about his new book. Man, is it a great read. The Tangled Tree, a radical new history of life. David, let's talk about horizontal gene transfer. Again, a lot of people associated with the development of this idea, and it's a radical idea. It's not just an idea. And I want to talk about Lynn Margulis, because you actually got to meet her.
Oh, yeah. I spent time with the wonderful Lynn Margulis. She was the 20th century, she lived a bit into this century, microbiologist, and she revived an idea that had been around earlier, but it was considered a crazy idea, and that was an idea that she labeled endosymbiosis. Endosymbiosis, the idea of symbiotic relationships with creatures that live inside our own cells. She revived this idea that essentially the main elements of it were that important internal organs in our cells, in the cells of complex creatures.
Like mitochondria,
which are the energy packaging internal organs in our cells, and also chloroplasts, which are the photosynthesizing organs in plants, that both of those important kinds of internal organs were actually captured bacteria that had been swallowed by some form of early cell billions of years ago, maybe 2 billion years ago, or a little bit more or less, and that those captured bacteria had evolved and been co-opted into serving as internal organs in the cells of complex creatures. And she did this on the basis of microscopy, looking through microscopes and looking at electron micrographs of complex cells, and saying these organs look a lot like bacteria.
Wow.
But then, after the Carl Woese revolution of genome sequencing began in the late 70s, people used that technique to test Lynn Margulis' hypothesis, because these internal organs had DNA. They had genomes in them. They had their own genomes. So people sequenced those genomes, and they said, wait, she was right. These are bacterial genomes inside these internal organs of our cells. So we contain, at our deepest level, captured bacteria now functioning as organs, you know, like a heart or a kidney might function in the human body.
The implication of this horizontal gene transfer is mind-blowing, because it changes the way we think about ourselves. I mean, we're not a single thing.
That's right. That's right, yeah. It changes how we think about the concept of species, one species distinct from another, not trading genes across species boundaries, but it also changes the way we think about individuals, including ourselves as human individuals. We now understand that we are composites, we are mosaics of other creatures that have been brought into us or have come into us. One scientist called it infective heredity, come into us in some cases by infection, but have inserted their genomes into our genomes.
Does that mean we're sort of more like a jellyfish and that we're like a colonial animal?
Well, in a way, jellyfish, we know they look like, a jellyfish looks like a single animal, but in fact it's a colony of semi-autonomous cells that are functioning with the division of labor to form this, actually it's the Portuguese man of war, that jellyfish are individuals, the Portuguese man of war.
Right, or colonial.
Which people think of as another form of jellyfish, are these colonial creatures. Yeah, we're a little bit different from that. There are differences of nuance, but for instance, every human genome, the genome of all of us, you and me and everybody we know, contains 8% viral DNA. 8% of our genome is viral DNA that has come in not by direct descent from our ancient animal ancestors, but sideways by infection from retroviruses that have not infected our immune cells the way HIV, which is a retrovirus, infects immune cells, inserts itself into the genome of the immune cell, but have infected our reproductive cells, ovaries and testes, eggs and sperm.
So it's affected evolution?
Absolutely. Absolutely. As a matter of fact, there is one of these viral genes that has gotten into our heritable DNA that is responsible for building a membrane between the placenta and the fetus humans that's completely necessary for successful human pregnancy. So this thing, we couldn't be what we are without this viral gene that has been repurposed from forming an envelope around a viral particle to forming a membrane between the placenta and the fetus in humans.
What about the speed of evolution? Because back in Darwin's time, and for Darwinian evolutionary people after that, you know, it was all a slow process.
Right.
Is horizontal gene transfer mean that things can be speeded up?
Yes, it does. It's important to understand the ways in which it challenges the conventional Darwinian view and the ways in which it simply supplements that.
Right, right.
Natural selection is still occurring. Darwin's great mechanism, natural selection, still occurs, but it acts on variation within populations, different possibilities. You know, there is a selection of, this is survival of the fittest. Some creatures, some humans, some others are have a genome that makes them more fit than others, and it was thought that the variation, this is the different part, the variation upon which natural selection acts arose by an incremental process of mutation, one bit by bit, tiny changes, tiny mistakes as DNA copied itself. And so these incremental variations were what natural selection acted on. Now we know that although that is still true, there is also another form of variation that can come in big lumps, in sudden quanta, by way of this horizontal transfer of genes, so that suddenly natural selection has a whole major new possibility to contemplate, to work on, to select from.
I want to talk a minute about Lynn Margulis's tree, because I love her tree, because it really sort of reflected the time. It does look like something R. Krem would have drawn.
Yes, yeah. She published her first work on this theory, endosymbiosis, in 67, you know, the summer of love
of
the 60s. And then she published a book in 1970 with this figure that was drawn for her by a Hungarian illustrator. And it does look like something that R. Crumb, the cartoonist, might have drawn. It is a funky 60s era tree of life. And you can almost hear the Grateful Dead thumping in the background when you look at this tree.
You're not old enough to remember those.
Oh, I sure am.
I definitely am.
I was in college in the late 60s.
Me too. Now, I wanted to digress a moment and talk about bacterial sex. Bacteria, as far as we know it, don't really have sex.
Right. Bacteria reproduce by fission, by splitting in half. One bacteria gets full of nutrients and full of protoplasm, and it splits, and then you have two bacteria all of a sudden. It doesn't involve the transfer of genes the way sex among animals involves the mixing of genes of the mother and the father. There is a phenomenon whereby bacteria transfer genes from one to another sideways down this little cord or little tube that grows between two bacterial particles. And this was the first form of horizontal gene transfer that was discovered by scientists using microscopes and seeing this happening. And as a metaphor...
Was that Fred Griffin in his research on pneumococcus?
This was more a little bit later. Okay. This was Joshua Lederberg.
Got it. And a very important person in
your
book. Yeah,
and he was seeing this. Fred Griffith had suggested that it had to be happening because he saw forms of bacteria that suddenly had been benign and they suddenly became virulent, forms of pneumonia. He didn't know why. Other scientists worked on this. I tell the story of Fred Griffith and then Oswald Avery discovering that DNA is the genetic material. And then in the 1950s, Joshua Lederberg and his wife Esther Lederberg are studying this, and they give this phenomenon the nickname bacterial sex. And, of course, who doesn't want to talk about bacterial sex?
Yeah.
But, in fact, it's a metaphor. It's not really bacterial sex because it doesn't involve reproduction. It just involves the mixing, the transfer of genes from one bacterium into another.
But at one point in your book, if I remember right, because there's so much to remember, somebody suggested, actually, that are there all these different species of bacteria? Or have they been exchanging genetic material horizontally so that there was actually all these sort of subspecies, but in fact, It's like one gigantic bacteria.
That's right. That's right. We call different kinds of bacteria species. You know, we say that Staphylococcus aureus is a species, and the famous E. coli is a species of bacterium. But with bacteria, it's, again, it's really just a metaphor. It's a blurry concept because they are passing genes sideways from one kind to another so profligately, so promiscuously, that it's really kind of artificial to even say this is one bacterial species versus another. And I talk about a wonderful Romanian scientist, Soren Sonea, who took this idea all the way out, and he said, there has been and continues to be so much horizontal gene transfer, one to another kind, among bacteria, that we may as well think of all bacteria on Earth as just one big species. And as a matter of fact, while we're at it, let's don't even call it a species. Let's call it one big organism. All bacteria on Earth with genes moving sideways across all of the boundaries.
Wow. And this has, you know, people are listening to this going, oh, it's all so theoretical. This has very practical and important implications for diseases that we suffer from.
It does. It does. With the increasingly severe issue of antibiotic resistance among bacteria, for a cardinal instance. Yeah. It used to be thought that, you know, bacteria evolve resistance to certain antibiotics. Okay, we've got Staphylococcus aureus, and it becomes resistant to methicillin, and we can't kill it, and so we've got something called MRSA, M-R-S-A, meth-resistant staph aureus, which is a big problem. It kills people. We used to be able to cure it with antibiotics. Now we can't. And so it was thought that these various different bacteria evolved resistance to antibiotic A or antibiotic B by the old-fashioned incremental mutation route. We now realize that, yes, that happens, and they do evolve resistance to one particular kind of antibiotic that way. But once that has evolved in one bacteria, one kind of bacteria, that resistance, that gene, or that package of genes for resistance to several different kinds of antibiotic can be passed sideways in an instant from one kind of bacteria into a completely different kind. So from Staphylococcus aureus into Salmonella, from Salmonella into E. coli. And that's why the problem of resistant kinds of pathogenic bacteria has spread around the world so quickly. It's killing tens of thousands of people a year just in the U.S.
Now, does horizontal gene transfer only happen on the microscopic level?
Well, no. I mentioned the ways that it happens and has happened among animals, including humans. I mean, this invasion of our genomes by viral DNA, retroviral DNA, is one form of horizontal gene transfer. It happens in animals. There are cases that have been documented where a certain stretch of DNA that is seen in, say, a frog in West Africa is also seen in a lizard in North America and a bat in North America and a lemur in Madagascar and a kissing bug in South America.
Which spreads Chagas's disease.
Which spreads Chagas's disease and may also spread stretches of DNA.
That's right. That is hereditary, isn't it?
Yes, right, right.
This is, I mean, reading your book really sort of broke down everything I learned as a kid. and I like that. I like that feeling, but it really gives you pause.
Well, and that's why the subtitle of this book is so modest, A Radical New History of Life. I'm not claiming that I've conceived a radical new history, but I'm describing this radical new history of life that was created by Carl Woese and the scientist who followed his influence.
I've got to ask you, how much did the technology of gene sequencing and CRISPR affect this? It must have sped up the discoveries.
Well, yes. The improved technology of automated gene sequencing was hugely important. Woese didn't have the benefit of that. He was doing this stuff by hand.
Can I stop you there? Because when I read about him doing his research, like the old-fashioned way, it blows my mind.
Yeah. He was like, when it came to gene sequencing, he was like a man crawling across the desert on his hands and knees to get a little bit of information using toxic chemicals and explosive solvents and high voltage and radioactive phosphorus to sequence a few stretches, fragments of DNA and RNA from a few organisms to compare them to one another. And it took him years to get the amount of genome information that a smart undergraduate can generate in an afternoon in a laboratory now using fancy automated gene sequencing machines.
When I read that in your book, I just felt so bad for Carl.
Yeah, the amazing thing is
he was doing it almost all visually. He would get these things, tack them up on the wall, and compare them. And it's amazing that he was able to accomplish anything.
That's right. He had these films. He would break a gene or a stretch of DNA or a stretch of RNA into small fragments, only 4, 5, 6, 8 letters of the genetic code, and then he would separate them using an electrical method so that they would spread out across a sheet of filter paper, as I say in the book, like these little ovals, like galloping amoebae in a race, and he would print them out because they had been eating radioactive phosphorus, so they were hot, and he would take a film of them using a great big X-ray film negative, and so he would be looking at these spots on a film negative on a wall, figuring out, well, what's this one? Is this one ATCC?
Wow,
you know, and. He said in print at one point, I would walk home some nights thinking, woes, you have destroyed your brain again today, because it was so laborious. And yet, what makes him important is that he was doing this when nobody else was willing to take the trouble or had the vision to do this kind of thing. He was going, without the fancy tools, going for the deep questions, wanting deep answers.
And that was his passion. That's what he always wanted to do. He wanted to know the big story.
That's right. He wanted to know, as he said to his friend Francis Crick, I want to push the story of evolution back a billion years before what we have now.
We're completely out of time. My guest tonight has been noted science writer David Quammen. And we've been talking about his book. I cannot recommend this book enough. The Tangled Tree, A Radical New History of Life. David, it's been a real pleasure.
Mark, thank you. I really enjoyed it, and I much appreciate your juice, your enthusiasm.
Oh, yeah. Well, how can you not like this book? You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.